Okay, thank you for your patience, everybody, and welcome to tropical Melbourne. My name is Charles, and I'd just like to say a few words about the contemporary so that you are aware of it, and then make some short introduction. So the contemporary is a charitable, not-for-profit, secular organization. It's been recently formed by a group of volunteers to promote a more deeply rooted and enduring kind of well-being in the community. And we seek to do this in ways that are informed by insights from science and the humanities and contemplative traditions. In particular, we understand that contemplative and ethical practices make available and cultivate deep sources of well-being that can be drawn from in the midst of the clamour of everyday life. So in this regard, we exist to provide opportunities for the development of a community of practice in urban life. We hope to bring to the community accomplished teachers from a range of traditions and disciplines who have something of benefit to share in this regard. And we hope that our educational courses, talks, public dialogues, workshops and retreats will make available practices and perspectives that will prove beneficial to the community in terms of its spiritual, psychological, social and eventually material well-being. And finally, we hope to support a community of researchers whose activities will add to our developing understanding of wherein lies our flourishing and that of the planet we inhabit. A couple of housekeeping points. If you do need to use the toilet, there are toilets located outside in this back garden area. You can just leave through the store and make your way around there. This is a free talk, but touring around Australia and New Zealand costs money, and Tara and Monique rely on donations and offerings to cover their costs. So if you'd like to make an offering to help in this way, you can do so by placing your in the wooden box on the table in the center back, just display as you leave. Okay, well, I'd like to introduce Tom Hardman first, who's one of the founding members of the Contemporary and a student of philosophy and the classics at the University of Melbourne. And Tom's really taken a leadership role with respect to conceptualising the contemporary's talks and public dialogues. And he'll be moderating this conversation today. So my thanks to you, Tom. And now I'd like to introduce Tara Choyin Lomo, who we're delighted and grateful to host. It's a rare opportunity to hear from a Western practitioner and contemplative who's immersed themselves so completely in the contemplative life, exploring the depths and potential of the inner life. Many of us have felt the benefits of integrating a few minutes of meditation or mindfulness into our daily lives. But what happens when you take this much further? Well, I hope we might find something out about this from Tara in conversation with Tom this evening and in response to questions from you, the audience. So many thanks, and over to you, Tom, to start this, and I'll try to fix up the other mic.
Thank you, Charles. Can you hear me? Am I having this at an appropriate distance from my mouth? So thank you, Tara, for coming. It's a great privilege for me personally to be able to talk to you, and thank you to all of you for coming as well. It's also you know, a great privilege and humbling to have the attention of so many faces. So Tara, I'd like to just begin with some questions about your background and just get an idea of the sort of story of your life, beginning with who you were before you became interested in Buddhism even, and how that happened, and what you were doing with your life.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? I think, yeah. Please excuse my English, as I'm from Austria. And having lived in Nepal and India for so long, the English, however good it might have been before, it gets really worse. When I was young, I was just a kid like everyone else. I had a very bad car accident when I was around 11 and a half, I think. And that car accident, through that car accident, I met with death for the first time, as the second husband from my mother died in that car accident. And I myself got hit very strongly, and I spent in hospital 4 months after the accident, and after that for the successive 5 years, every year 2 to 3 months in hospital doing different operations. So that was for me the first time the question arose, what is actually the meaning of life? After I had found out that my mom's partner has passed away, whom I loved very much. So at that time there was a Christian nurse. I mean, they're all Christian, but there was one nurse who was really more into Christianity and into the practice. So I started talking to her a little bit about Christianity. But then back to normal life and just go to school. And in my 15, 16, 17, 18 in those years, I had lots of different hobbies and sports and arts. I played piano, I played guitar. For 3 years, I was in a ballroom dancing until where we do competition. I did ski racing, I did all kinds of sports. I did drama, I played drama for 5 years. I did arts photography. So I did lots of different things, trying to find satisfaction, like we always try to find in whatever we do. But I never found it. And that's why, with 17, 18, the question came back again. What is really the meaning of life? What is the purpose of my life? What should I do? And after I graduated, I decided to go for 1 year to America, and I graduated in America. That was more just for fun, getting out of the country and to learn English better. Not much left anymore. But in that time, I took an evening college course on world religions and looked at all the 5 major religions, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and Judaism. And Buddhism was the one which really struck me. You say that? Yeah, struck me. And so I got an idea of a spiritual path, which could be interesting, but I still lacked any connection. So when I came back from America, I looked for a job as a photographer because I just felt that's what I want to do for the moment. So I became assistant of a photographer, and I think I stayed with him 8 or 9 months until I ran off to Nepal. And that was my first and last job I ever did. And that was also my, I think, good connection I got there, because at that time, close to the studio, there was a Buddhist center in Vienna, and next to the Buddhist center was a vegetarian restaurant where I used to eat, and I always saw this center, but I was too shy to go in. I always just looked from outside, looked at the pictures of those teachers who were coming, and always kind of wished I'd like to go there. So I was 19, but I was too shy to go there. And then it happened, one Tibetan Lama came to the center, and the photographer I worked with, he had a very good friend from a different part of Austria who was Buddhist since quite some years already. So he came to Vienna and he stayed with us in the studio. And that was my fortune then, because he then took me to the center. And when I came there, one of the things that I directly felt very, very at home in this actually quite weird, strange Tibetan Buddhist center, but it felt very, how it says, if you know something, it feels like something you know.
Familiar,
yeah, it felt very familiar. And when the Lama then started out his teachings, as it's always started with the proper motivation, why he would teach and why we would attend the teaching, and that proper motivation would be for the benefit of all sentient beings, may I attain enlightenment. And when I heard that sentence, I knew that's what I want to do. That's the meaning of my life. And it was at the time where I actually was about to decide what I really want to do. One thing was I wanted to study medicine because of the gratitude I felt the doctors, how they repaired my body. So I thought I also want to become a surgeon and help other people. Then the other thought was being a photographer. And the third thought was going into the tourism branch, studying tourism management. But I couldn't decide for anything because it always left that question, but where is the purpose of it? I'm born, I went to school, now I'm doing this profession, and then I'm going to die. I just couldn't see the real meaning and purpose, and it also didn't give me imagining that, it didn't give me the feeling like I would reach satisfaction and fulfillment. So I didn't go in either of those. So at that point, that Lama came. And so when I heard this motivation prayer, then I understood, okay, now my decision is done. I want to do that. It's not a profession to earn money, but I thought I can do that. And of course, I have to say I had the good fortune out of the car accident. So everything has always two sides, as we know. So the good side of it was because of the private insurance my father had made, I got quite a bit money out of that car accident, out of all that time in hospital and all the operations. So I had the money to actually just go off. And that, of course, was the good condition, because if I wouldn't have had that, my parents definitely, they were not willing to support me, because their view was, they didn't understand what I want. And that time I was just too young and too new myself that I could have explained to them. So for them it was just, okay, she's running off to India, Nepal, and don't know whatever she's doing there. But so they didn't want to support me either. So it was good I had that money from which I lived, I think, maybe 3 to 5 years. I lived from that money. And I remember after 3 years, 3 or 5 years, I came back to Austria once. And I gave the last bit of my money I gave for my father, whose boiler, hot water boiler, that's how you say, was broken and he couldn't afford to buy a new one. So I gave him the last bit of the money I had because I had the confidence I will be okay. I will be able to go on. So what happened that time when the Lama came, I took what we call refuge, means similar something like in the Christian baptize, like we say, okay, I really want to go the path and I take refuge to the Buddha and the teachings of the Buddha. And I directly, this Lama stayed for 1 week, gave different teachings, and from that day on, my life already changed 180 degrees. Before, I used to be in the studio, be partying, hardly ever go home, like mostly I slept in the studio, until night we would work, and then we would party, you know, like artist people life is a little bit unsteady. So I liked it. But that moment when I really found my path, everything just fell off from me. Like all the interest I had before, the arts and the music and the sports and everything, whatever I spent my life with before, just fell off. There was just no interest anymore. And from that day on, whenever my job was done in the studio, I packed my things and went home and started to practice. And maybe 2-3 months later, another lama came, who then turned to be out my personal lama. Means like with that lama, I really felt a strong connection. And he also asked me, he said, that was like in June or so, and he said in a few months later, in September, he has organized a pilgrimage to the holy places in India with his German disciples, if I would like to join. So that was for me the great opportunity. I was really happy he was offering that. And I said, yeah, thank you very much, definitely, I want to join. So, yeah, that was that's how I started to go off. Actually, only with the thought of going for the pilgrimage, 1-2 months, and then coming back. But once I was there, so we went on this pilgrimage in India, and then we came back to Nepal. This lama, he is actually from India, but he lived in Nepal. And when I was back in Nepal with him, then I thought, I suddenly had this feeling, okay, I don't want to return home. I found my path, I found my life, what I want to do. So I decided to stay. And that lama, he's very practice-oriented. Means his lineage, our practice lineage, is like his lama was also what we call an accomplished being. Like someone who has spent many, many, many years also in retreat in the mountains and really realized certain insights. Those people are called Mahasiddhas. Means Maha means like great, and Siddha means an accomplished being. So it's in the blessing of our lineage already, and in the nature of our lineage, that it's very much into practice. Also, my lama his heart was really with the practice. So when I stayed there, I was always very good in school and in study, and it always was very easy, everything. So I thought I would study philosophy and maybe become a translator. But he, from beginning on, he said, no, don't do that. We just study the basic books, the basic understanding for the Buddhism, and the rest I will just teach you, and you go into practice, you go into retreat. Don't waste the time. I had studied before I went to Nepal. I had studied one semester Tibetan language in Vienna at the university. So I had a basic grammar I understood. So then being in Nepal with my lama, studying a few texts and studying within the Tibetan, it came quite easily. And it came quite easy for me, the language, to understand. So, and especially then, as I had all these Tibetan texts, it could develop very easily and very quickly because we were reading all these Tibetan texts for the practice. So, yeah, that's how I started out to be there. And in that year, already in 1992, in the first year after the pilgrimage, my lama had put me in my first retreat experience, which was just 1 week. And after 3 days, I was already kind of jumpy and wanting to go out. And because retreat in my lineage means it's a real solitary, closed retreat, means you are more or less locked in a room or in a small apartment. You don't see anyone, you don't talk to anyone, except the lama who guides you, or maybe in certain situations, if you have a retreat helper, then if it's necessary, you might be able to see him, but usually we don't see anyone and we don't talk.
Thank you. There are lots of interesting points that came up in listening to your story. One of the things I was struck by is how sudden it all seemed to happen. And so, and you seem to be kind of quite committed to this path after you weren't dwelling on it for a long time, just as you said, it just fell away. So it wasn't, you know, when I imagined what going into retreat would be like, and I guess this was sort of spontaneous, so it wasn't something you kind of were planning to do, it just happened that way. But there wasn't any kind of pain of renunciation at that stage, it wasn't...
Well, when I was in Nepal, like before I went into the first retreat, after the pilgrimage, we stayed in Kathmandu in a place that is called Bodhanath. There's a very old, old, famous big stupa. So I always went for kora, means for circumambulation. We go for circumambulation. And going there, I always see all these beggars and handicapped people in Nepal, and it's normal. They are just out on the street, legs cut, arms cut, and they just crawl around and beg for the money. And I would, almost every day, I would return home crying because, I saw all this suffering and I didn't know what to do about it. I felt so helpless about it. And I would always talk to my Lama, what can we do about all this suffering? And he said, yeah, I mean, that's what the Buddhist path is about. You can't, there is not, we can help temporarily, we can help to relieve the temporary suffering of some beings by, giving them food, giving them medicine, doing something. But we just will never be able to really remove that suffering. So he said, what we do is, with that motivation, wanting to help the beings to remove their suffering, we go the path, because from the Buddhist view, we say only by realizing and accomplishing the true wisdom and compassion, we can help the beings. And why? Because finally everyone can only help oneself. Because in the Buddhist path we talk about karma, means cause and condition. Means every suffering we have comes from negative deeds we have done in lives before. We also talk about reincarnation. And we talk about countless lives we have gone through in different forms of incarnation. And whatever we do with body, speech, and mind, means every thought also we think, everything we say and everything we do has its consequences. And it has a basic principle. Positive deeds, positive thoughts, positive speech has positive consequences. And negative deeds have negative consequences. They bring suffering. So therefore, when we suffer in our lives, it's actually something we have created ourselves. So therefore also, we ourselves only can remove it by turning our minds towards more positive, trying to purify it from the negative, and trying to purify body, speech, and mind from keeping us from negative thoughts, emotions, negative talkings, and negative behavior. And only that will be able to finally bring us happiness and liberation. So knowing that, which also makes, for me, it made perfectly sense hearing about that philosophy. And so I thought, as it says, a blind person can't lead another blind person. That's an example that's many times used. So it's about getting your eyes opened. And that's what it's about, to go on the path. And therefore, as my Lama explained to me, and as I said, his lineage, his system was just about practice, practicing. So he says, practice, go into retreat, practice. So at some point, you will do your best to try to get as far as possible in order then to help others.
So I have two questions. One, I'd like to have an idea about what these practices you were doing in the beginning were, what the kind of first taste of Buddhist meditative practices were, and what was the importance of them for you. I know it's really difficult to describe often practice, but it's the most enticing question as well.
It's a little bit difficult to describe because I followed what we call the Tibetan Buddhism. So there are different Buddhist directions, different paths. Roughly, we divide them into three parts, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. So, for example, Theravada Buddhism, some people might have heard, that belongs to the Hinayana tradition, and Zen Buddhism, I think, quite strongly belongs to the Mahayana tradition. And the Tibetan Buddhism belongs to the Vajrayana tradition. But Vajrayana is also a part of the Mahayana. So the great two differences is Hinayana, Mahayana. In the Hinayana tradition, we understand the suffering of this life existence, and we understand all the principles about karma, and we have the wish to free ourselves from that suffering. We want to get out of that continuous rebirth, out of ignorance, out of not understanding, and out of following our negative emotions. They bind us into being reborn again and again. So on the Hinayana path, we just want to get out of that suffering. On the Mahayana path, it's not just we want to get out of the suffering, it's actually we want to get all the beings out of that suffering. So it's not may I be free, may I be out, but may I get at least as far that my eyes are open so I can help others and show the path for the others to try to get out. And Vajrayana Buddhism is part of the Mahayana path. But then there is again, therefore it might be a little bit complicated, then there is again on the Mahayana, there is again the Sutta and the Tantra path. And the Sutra path is more like the Zen Buddhism, it's more into only meditation. People only meditate. And they use what is called the six paramitas in the daily life to purify negative karma and to accumulate the positive karma. Those six, what we call six paramitas, means like the six perfections. They are practices about patience and generosity and morality and discipline and effort and the wisdom. And the Tantra path involves many, 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 many different methods. So we don't sit from the beginning on. We don't sit just in meditation, because the Tantra path has the opinion that it says the mind is the most difficult to tame. The mind is so jumpy and it's so used to destruction that it's very difficult to start out with sitting, just sitting down and trying to meditate. So what they say is at first we purify negative karma and accumulate positive karma through body and speech mainly. Of course, body, speech and mind. But means we do, for example, we do what we call prostrations. We prostrate to the Buddha and to the teachings and to our teacher. And we pray for enlightenment. And we do practices like visualizations and mantra recitations, for example, then also for purification. We visualize with light and with mantra that all the negativity gets out, is purified from us, and the light goes out to all the beings, that all the beings become purified. And so in that way, there are countless different, what we call, methods. The aim, or what it aims, is the same like in a meditation. Like in the beginning, the main thing is to aim is one-pointedness, mindfulness, to create, to be able to the mind to settle, to concentrate on something. But because we say it's difficult just sitting down, and because people who have tried meditation, they will probably have found out that the mind is just running in 1,000 directions continuously. So so it's easier if we can concentrate on something to do. Of course, the mind also runs off, but then, and it's also maybe a little bit more interesting according to our inclination. Some people, they like just to have it quiet and sitting, and some people, they need maybe more some happenings So according to whatever inclination we have, we will feel whatever path feels more suitable for us. And I didn't actually have a choice. I didn't choose. I didn't think about it. It's just also what we call karma. It's just that was the way I met with my path, and where I totally felt comfortable with. So I didn't have any thought about, okay, I should try out first something else. Or
So you took the tantra. So you took the tantra path. That was the path you were going down, and you began with things like prostrations and prayer, and,
right?
And mindfulness came later.
I mean, mindfulness comes during the practice. That's the thing. The method is used to create the mindfulness. We don't just sit trying to create mindfulness. We create the mindfulness by concentrating on something we do, on the prostration, and later also on the visualization. Visualization. Always try to keep it clear. Do the prayers, do the mantra. Like, focus your mind means create mindfulness. And there are many. Like it also says, be mindful on when you eat and in between. Like retreat means you have four sessions mainly. You get up like at 3:30 in the morning. You get up. You have your first session until breakfast. Then you have your second session until noon, and then the afternoon is divided into two parts with a tea break. And then after dinner, we do other like readings or prayers or like extra practices. So of course, it also says also during the practice, during the session, we know what we have to do. We do our practice, and we know we must focus on it. But then, of course, we also try during the times in between. It says like don't start totally like running off. Try to really keep focused with the mind. So I would say, like the actual meditation, in my case, like the plain meditation without any recitation, without nothing, only the plain meditation, I think only started, when was that? 97, I think. It means 5 years later.
Right. Yeah. That's reassuring. What about your? So, could you describe for us your teachers in the community in Nepal? So, my understanding is that you first went to Nepal, and then you spent a number of years in Kathmandu before going to solitary retreat. And in your talk in London, you described that environment as being like a family. And I'm interested in what you meant by that, and how important that community was to sustain what is a very, austere and solitary way of life.
I was very fortunate at the time that my Lama, who has come from India, he did not have established monastery yet. So he just came and had built a house. It was still that time when I came, it was still in the raw state. The house was finished, but it was in the raw state. So in difference to other lamas, mostly they have monasteries with many monks they have to take care of, and they have lots of work. So they're very busy. So they can't take care too much of each single disciple they have. So my Lama did not have that yet. He was just with one nephew and with another monk attendant. He was living in that house. So another German student from him and me really lived like a family with him. Means we ate together, we cooked together, we shopped together. And we did all the, like he really personally could teach me. He taught me on the texts, he taught me on the Tibetan language, he taught me on the basic Buddhist philosophy, and of course he taught me on my practice I need to do in retreat, because that works, it's like a gradual process. There's something we call a three-year retreat. It's a kind of an expression nowadays used very much. People might have heard it, three-year retreat. It's not about the 3 years, it's not about the time, because what they call three-year retreat, it took me 7 years. But it's about a certain program to absolve. And of course, it took me much longer because my Lama wanted me to do it all in the traditional way, means in the Tibetan language and with the Tibetan texts, which are very long sometimes. And as it's not my own language, of course, I can talk it only more slower, so everything took more time for me. And it's a certain program, like step by step. Like actually the first practice we do is in contemplation. It's not the prostration yet, it's in contemplation, about the four thoughts turning the mind towards the spiritual path, towards the Dharma. And those four thoughts we contemplate on are about, we say, this very precious human birth we have got, this human body we got, which enables us to go a spiritual path, which enables us with the intellect we have to choose between right and wrong, and to choose where we want to go and what we want to do. And like an animal can't choose, it's just trapped in its state of instinctive being. So we can go beyond that. We can evolve, or how to say, evolve, through the spiritual path. So that's a very precious opportunity we have, because in the Buddhist philosophy we say it's not that easy to get a human, to be born as a human being. They talk about six different realms where beings are born, like the hell realms and something what we call hungry ghosts. It's a state of fear where beings suffer a lot of hunger and thirst and these conditions. Then there's the human birth, there's the animal birth, and there is the gods, the god realm, and the kind of half-god realm, they call it. So the human birth is like this: the lower states, they have too much suffering and there's too much confusion, and they only live on the instinct. They have no chance to do any spiritual path. The higher states, like the gods, it said they just live in paradise. They have everything, they have no suffering, so they don't even consider a spiritual path. So the human birth is the best birth because it's a mixture of a little bit of both. We have a little bit suffering, we also have a little bit happiness, and we have the good condition to actually, choose our path, what we want to do. And it's nice, they have there is an example how they say how precious the human birth is. We get reborn continuously. We die, we get reborn, we die, we get reborn. We talk about a beginning and endless cycle of rebirths. So we have been reborn like countless times. It's nothing we can count. And they say to be born as a human being is as rare as a blind turtle in the ocean, which every 100 years only, it's coming on the surface, and on the big ocean, a wood ring is swimming. And that one time in 100 years, the turtle comes up, it would go into the wood ring. So they compare how precious it is to be a human being. And so that should be a motivation for us to really use our lives meaningful on the path. That is the first thought. Then the next contemplation is about karma, about cause and result, to become aware how much we are really responsible for our lives and for our successive lives, to really start taking responsibility on our body, speech, and mind. And then there's the contemplation about impermanence. Impermanence that goes through everything we see. In samsara, there is not, like in our world here, in our life, there is not one single thing which is permanent. No matter what it is, it's impermanent. It's changing. It's changing. Everything that is born dies. Every plant, every being, every building, everything is impermanent, which also our lives, like also to be mindful about, I'm not living forever. I don't have 100 years to waste. I have to really use my life now, because we don't know, tomorrow I might be dead. And it's not a negative thought, because sometimes people say, oh, it's so depressive or negative. No, it's not negative at all. It's just realistic. It's just being aware of our conditions and using this awareness of our conditions actually as a motivation to really get started to fulfill some purpose with our life. And the fourth thought is, the fourth contemplation is about the nature of suffering in this world, which also people say, yeah, it's so negative, it's not all about suffering. Of course it's not all about suffering. Of course people have happy times and happy moments. But why we say the basic nature is suffering? Because as long as we are ignorant and involved in negative emotions, we always create suffering. We want something. Okay, we get it. We feel happy at that moment. But then, when that thing or that person leaves us or gets destroyed or is gone, then there's the suffering. So, because the happiness is not permanent, there will always come the suffering afterwards. Not even looking at the actual suffering many people have with the health, with problems in the family, financial problems, or whatever suffering beings in this world have. So these four contemplations, which is kind of a meditation, but I don't call it a meditation because we don't just quietly meditate. We actually really think, we contemplate about those thoughts. And there are many teachings on those thoughts which we can like look at and think about and contemplate until we really get this feeling, oh, I can't just now relax my life and just do something. I really have to go on the path. I really have to go on some spiritual path, really use my life. So, that's what we actually started out. I think in the meantime, I forgot your question.
That's okay, that was a very interesting answer. I'm conscious about the time, and I have so many questions I'd like to ask you, but I feel we should get a better idea of how events progress. So you went in the fall, and you spent some time in Kathmandu, and then eventually you went to one of the caves of Milarepa. Could you explain how that happened and the significance of Milarepa and your living conditions?
Okay, I get back to this, how it gradually. Okay, yeah. So, I first did around 3 years. It's also solitary retreat, but it's not that solitary as it's in the city, as there around are people. But solitary in the sense of, we close our door, we don't see anyone, we don't talk. So at first my Lama, because he knows it has to be done gradually, because our habitual patterns are very strong of being social, of talking, of wanting distractions. So it's very difficult for the mind to be in retreat, and also for the body, but especially for the mind. So we do it slowly, like you do a week, then you do a month, then you do a few months. And also the outer conditions. At first, I was in this comfortable house of the Lama, had a comfortable bed, and I was cooked for, had good food. So the outer conditions were quite comfortable and easy. So I really, because it's already difficult enough to be locked in a room. So like that, gradually I did, until 1995. In 1995-96, we started to look for retreat land, for a land out in the mountains to get a little bit more out in the solitude in the mountains. So we found a piece of land at the border of Tibet. And people from Lhapchi, that's the place where I later went to, they actually helped us find that land and to build the retreat houses. So we built some retreat houses there, and so I stayed 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000 for 5 years. I stayed there. But out of these 5 years, so that was a little bit more step into solitude. But still, I had a person who was looking after me and whom I could write paper when I needed something. So he would go down to the village. It was like 2 hours up the mountain. He would go down to the village, buy the food, buy the things for me, what I need, and be nearby. So I felt in a safe environment. And from there, behind the mountains in the Himalayas, I knew about a place called Lhapchi, which is one of the three most holy mountains in Tibet. And they were prophesied by Buddha. And also the most famous Tibetan yogi called Milarepa, who attained enlightenment in one lifetime. He practiced many, 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 many years. He practiced on that mountain. And successively after that, also many practitioners had stayed in this mountain in different caves and huts and all around. It said that at the peak time there were like 55,000 practitioners there. So I don't know how they would have fitted, but it's the whole area. Then it's not only that mountain, it's the whole area. So I knew about that place, and because the life story of Milarepa was the very first Buddhist book I read, which really gave me that strong inspiration, because he underwent a lot of hardships and he really devoted his life to enlightenment. So he lived for decades in the empty Himalayas and doing his, took lots of hardships doing his practice. So that was my inspiration. And so I always felt like I want to get to that place there. But also, like I said, it has to successively grow. The capacity in us has to grow. I knew in the beginning years I wouldn't have the capacity to go there, to be like just totally in the solitude by myself. I would be afraid. I was too worried about food, too worried about the cold, just worried about our general things we need to live. So being in the retreat center in the mountains was already a little bit a training from getting everything more simple. And in the last 2 years of those 5 years, I started going then in summertime, during the summer months, I went to Lhapchi, to that place Lhapchi, because wintertime it snows, it has like minus 20 degrees, it's up about 4,500 meters in the Himalaya, and it's total solitude. It's 6 days of walking. It's for 1 day with the bus from Kathmandu, and then you walk 6 days. One reason was also for the long walking, because I couldn't take the official path, because that place was, that time it was still a restricted area. That means foreigners were not allowed to go there. So we went via secret path just from our retreat land, just wild through the mountains, actually also going, crossing Tibet, going wild through the mountains about 6 days to reach Lhapchi. The official path took 5 days. And later on, they opened it for foreigners also. But the first 2 years, we always had to go that secret path. And so it's totally out in the solitude. The next village where there would be shops simple shops, small village, would be like 2 days walking away. So that place itself is like really out in the nothing. There is no village, there are no shops, there are no telephone, there is totally nothing. There's a small, tiny, very old monastery down in the valley. And then up on the mountain and all around, there are all these little caves. And I mean, most are like kind of half caves, and then people used to like build around, just put stones and window and something and make it a house, kind of. And so the first 2 times I only stayed in summer times, because of course that was already challenge enough. Now I had to learn making fire, which I never did before, which was really difficult. Summertime is raining time, so wood, everything is wet. And me as a actually city girl from Vienna, never had made a fire. So it's not that easy. You have to get a feeling for how you put the woods and everything, otherwise it just doesn't burn. But they have a trick, like you would then blow on it. So I would just spend all the time blowing on it, because it wouldn't burn otherwise. So that means I had to go back to very simple food, which means like in the first year I actually didn't eat cooked food, because just to get 1 liter water boiled, it would take me an hour or so, just sitting and blowing and blowing and blowing. So there was no way I could like stop and doing any cooking. So I just get this 1 liter hot water. And I ate what we call tsampa. That's like the daily bread of the Tibetans. It's barley, roasted barley, and then ground it to a flour. And then we just add tea or water and butter. In my case, I just added cold water, actually, because I didn't have enough the warm water I wanted for drinking. So just add the cold water, mix it. And because it's roasted, you can just eat it like that. So that was my food for the first summer I spent there. In the second summer, I went a little bit far. I brought rice, and I started with cooking rice soup, because that also doesn't take much attention. You can still put your attention on the fire and just have the rice soup cooking. But slowly later, I got very good in fire, and I started making bread and things and noodles, like we bring flour. So we have to buy all the food from Kathmandu. So we buy basic things like rice, flour, lentils, the different beans, all that stuff that keeps for a long time, because we buy it for half year or for a year, and we hire sherpas, or how to say, porters. They help us to carry that stuff up, because for 6 days carrying, mostly it's like then you have 100 kg or so if you take food for 1 year. So I would only spend the summer times, because that was already difficult enough for the beginning. And then in the third year, when I went again, I didn't really think about it. But I assumed I just wanted to stay the summer. But as there was an old lama who also came that time, and he decided to stay in the winter time. He will stay on. So then, ambitious as I was, I thought, okay, if that old lama can stay, I should be able to do it. So I decided to stay. Which is, nobody stays in winter time there. So that time they were in the small monastery, there are like 5 monks. And there are nomad people who come up in summertime with the animals, and they go even more high up in the mountains. And in winter time they move down like 1 day walking distance from there. And that place is just empty. No human being there in winter time, because it can snow quite a lot. It does not always snow too much, but it can snow quite a lot. And then it's difficult with water and with anything for everyone. So that time, my first winter I spent there, it was that lama and a monk with him and me. We were 3 people, which was quite intensive, the feeling, because you're up in the Himalaya, the far you look, it's all the snow mountains, and you know there's no human being around. So that's when I decided to stay the first winter also, which actually I was quite afraid. That time when people were gone, I started crying. I thought maybe I made a mistake, because suddenly I really felt, okay, now it's too late, everyone is gone. But I survived very well. And like that, then I got started doing retreat there. So before it was like then summer there. In winter time, I went back to the retreat center. Summer time go up, winter time go down. And after that, I stayed winter, summer, continuously.
Right. And for how many years in total did that retreat last?
Up in Lapche.
Yeah.
Yeah, up in Lapche it was, like at first this the 2 summer periods, and then it was 2 years continuously, summer, winter, summer, winter. And then I got a letter from my teacher calling me back to Kathmandu, because my mother hasn't seen and heard from me in 5 years. And she started to get worried. And so she wrote a letter to my Lama saying, where is my daughter? So he sent a letter and said, come down. Your mother wants to see you. She kind of said she wants to come to Nepal. But she just tricked me. She didn't do it. She just, when I was down in Kathmandu, she said, please come to Austria. So I went for, I think, 3 months that time. I went back, which was really disturbing for me, because I was not ready yet to be again exposed to that world here, and I couldn't handle it very well. I think I wasn't very nice to the people. And then I went back again. Then I stayed for another 1 year successively. I went up in winter, in autumn, stayed until the next autumn. And then I have three main teachers. So then His Holiness, who is like the leader, the head of our tradition, he then said, I should leave Lapje and I should go out a little bit and should start carrying my practice to the outside again. Because up to then, yeah, especially from, can say from 95, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, I had done 9, 10 years like really intensive, close, solitary retreat, and he had the feeling I might be a little bit stuck, because if you're in retreat, of course you don't have the outside challenges. I mean, there's lots that comes from the inside, there's lots to do from there, but then you reach a point where all the stuff from inside, you got really deep in your subconscious and everything is quite cleared. But there's still all this dust there, which you only feel and see when it's being blown up by different conditions and challenges. So my Lama said, go out, go, leave Lapje, go out. And I really started, I felt extreme, what we call obstacles, like really difficulties coming, not being able to handle my mind and to handle the practice as well as I wanted. And I asked the Lama three times on different occasions, please let me go back to retreat. But he said, no, don't go now. Now it's important that you really face those situations and that you handle them, that you win over them. And yeah, so from that time on, I was again, then it started like half year in retreat, half year out, half year in, half year out. And I had to do, like the Lama then got me to do some translation works and different jobs I had to do during the time when I was out. So yeah, that was then a new cycle of training.
Well, it's been over an hour of talking, and the plan for this evening was to... So I believe that the website said that the talk will go for 3 hours, but we're going to keep it at 2. And the plan for this evening was to have this part of the discussion and then speak about wisdom and compassion and then do a Q&A with the audience. But I think, given the time, maybe the best thing to do would be to hand it over to the audience. And if you're happy with that time, and see where the questions go.
I'm very happy with that.
Yeah, sure. So, does anybody have a question? If not, I've got plenty. Okay.
This works now.
Sure. One, two, three.
Yeah.
I get to be the first person. You don't have a shaved head, you have a different hairstyle. Can you explain your hair?
Well, as it's now, it doesn't have any meaning. But, I have a few left of my dreadlocks. Like, actually, I had, during the time of my retreat, maybe some people, I don't know, have seen the picture from me with my Lama, like on the, in the internet where you put that speed, where this talking was published. So there was a picture of me and my Lama. So it's the kind of yogic tradition that in retreat, in order to really focus only on the practice and not about body and hair and everything, so we just let the hair just be as it is. So what happens, it starts clotting and we start getting these dreadlocks, which I had very long and all of full of dreadlocks, and we would bind them up. So if you have seen that picture, I had like a big thing like that of the dreadlocks bind up, which is very uncomfortable and heavy on the neck. And at some point my Lama just said, okay, just cut them down, and I had them cut down like 2 times. And then now and later I mostly cut them off and just kind of for still for the kind, we say, how to say, for the feeling of, still being in retreat. As I also still go to retreat, I thought I'll leave a few. I can carry them. They are not too heavy. And, then just I bind them up. That's it.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Just wondering about your current practice or your practice when you're not in retreat. So when you're going about your other business, how often do you practice and how much, and how do you find that whole thing?
So also over all the years, whenever we are not in retreat, we have to maintain what we call a daily practice. And that can be more or less, it depends also on the path, which part we are in. Usually we have to take all the practice with us as far as we get. But then at a certain point, when we mainly focus on meditation, which is like the last quite some years of my practice, I didn't do much other anymore than the actual meditation. So then this different practices of recitations and visualizations and so on and so on, we do very little only. But I do, when no matter where I am, if I'm in Austria, if I'm on my travel now, as long as it's somehow possible, like today we had the flight in the morning, so I couldn't sit. Usually I couldn't sit until noon, so usually I would be in until noon. When I was in Austria now for a while because my mother was sick and I helped her to go through the sickness, and that's where Monique took the chance to bring me to Australia. So in Austria, in Australia, in Nepal, wherever I am, I'm in my practice until noon. And then in the evening again, at least one hour, up to 2 hours, depends how much time I have. And in the morning, 4 or 5 hours, usually I sit.
Hello, Tara.
Hi.
I can't even imagine what it would feel like for you to come back into society after so long. Was part of the difficulty the fact that you experienced so much suffering in the people that you saw around you? And was there a thought or a feeling like you wanted to try and help those people?
I think the first part of your question was about the difficulty being back here. I had it now since a few years. Like I said, my Lama threw me out. And so I had it since a few years, be in, be out, be in, be out. And the last 2012, since 2012, I spent quite a lot of time, lots of time in Austria, because before my father got sick, then after all these years retreat and with my accident I had before, I really got problems with my hip and my knee. So I had to do therapy. I thought I have to do the operation, but they still postponed it to give me an artificial joint. Nowadays, everything possible. So, so I have been in Europe now the last few years, quite a lot. And so now it's no difficulty for me anymore at all. I can handle that change very easily, because it's also, I'm more, with my practice, I'm really more deeper now. So, and everything is more like an illusory, dreamlike happening. So, you get more detached of whatever is happening. So then you can also handle it more easily. It doesn't matter anymore where you are, what you do. And the second question with the suffering here, it's always when I come here, I can see a very strong sense of mental suffering of the people in the West, whereas people in Nepal and India, they still suffer from more, much more basic things like food and health and all that stuff. And here, everything is so nice, so comfortable, so advanced, but people are definitely, seems like, much more unhappy. and much more suffering than in the still simple countries. So I always feel very sad and very touched for it, because me having gone through all that path and really having attained to a certain stage of or state of peaceful, of peace and of joy and of happiness, means the inner happiness which is not relying on where I am or what I'm doing or what I'm eating or where I'm sleeping. It's just a stable joy you find in yourself. And having found that afterwards, I think it's so easy. Why cannot just, everyone just do it and be happy? The outer conditions are great here. And if the people would just start focusing inside more, then, I mean, all the Western life is about outside, going outside, focusing outside, making the outside better and better and better and better, instead of going the inside. And that's where the problem lies. That's where they are missing themselves. And so that also then started really the motivation of really wanting to help, wanting to benefit. So then Monique approached me, and she really asked me. It went on for almost 2 years, 1.5 years, 2 years. She really always, she kept asking, please, will you come for talks? Please come for talks. And I always said no, because, I thought, what should I talk? I mean, I just went my path, and I'm still on my path, and that's just my life. What is there to talk about? But she said, you don't know. It's very inspiring. It was so inspiring for me when I met you. It's inspiring for people just to hear the story, and you tell a little bit about your life. So at some point when I was in Austria now, helping my sick mother, then I also thought, I'm here already, so taking care of my mother, why should I not, what was the basic motivation for the whole path? Help the beings as much as you can. So I thought, why not now just try it out and do it. I have nothing to lose. I said to Monique, I don't know what I should talk, but you think I talk? Okay, I talk. People like it or not like it, I don't know. You will see. So that's what I do now at the moment.
Thank you, Tara.
Did everyone hear the question? No.
Tara, were there difficult times when you first began to stay with the practice? And if that was so, what did you do?
Of course there were difficult times. There were enormous difficult times. Like, I cried a lot. Because what do we have to deal with? We have to deal with our habitual patterns, which we don't even feel as long as we are in there. We live our daily life. We eat what we eat. We meet with friends. We watch TV. We listen to music. We get up in the morning, turn the button of the radio, listen to the music. We just have a very habituated life. And it seems like it's not important for us at all. But the moment it's taken from you, like if you're in retreat and all of that is not there anymore, then suddenly you are like, what's happening? What's happening? Where is the radio? Where is my talking? Where is my books? Where is my going out? Where is my food? Where is my this? Where is my that? Where is my this? So it's very difficult. Also from the outer condition, of course, being born and having grown up in our Western comfortable culture, it's of course difficult than moving to a country like Nepal, a third world country, really dirty, and the water, and all the sicknesses, and the food, and everything. And up in the mountains, no heating, nothing. You sit there with the minus 20. I had up to minus 7 in the room. Like, whatever water was there, everything would be freezing. So you deal on the physical level, you deal with lots of really difficulties, but even more so the difficulties from the mind and from our emotions. And then being alone, all that stuff that comes up, And through the meditation and through the practice, you're diving deeper and deeper into your being, which is wonderful and on the one hand, and also never gets boring. Therefore, this path, you can do it forever, and it would never repeat itself because you always discover new things and you always have new things to work with. But it's also, it's very hard also. But especially like my Lama always explained to me also, the main thing is to understand all the suffering, the difficulties we have is actually mostly about these habitual patterns. Also our thoughts are habitual patterns. And the emotions that arise, like on certain situations, we react in a very automatic pattern-wise way. We are not aware of until the moment it happens, until the moment we shout, or until the moment we beat someone, or until the moment we do something, we realize, that we are just in a state of very strong emotionality. So also that is a very strong pattern. So the whole path is actually through mindfulness. We fight. It feels like a fight against those patterns. And therefore some people say, it feels so unnatural. And I say, of course it feels unnatural, because the habitual patterns, they feel so familiar and comfortable. So when we start going against them, it feels like a fight. And then people would say, why should I fight against my own nature? But that's not your nature, that's the point. Like when we start getting rid of those habitual patterns, then only we start to discover really our free nature, who can just in this moment, in this situation, can sense what's going on and working with that. We don't walk out of a pattern, we walk out of that moment. And so I would say, I always say, for when did my life become easier? I think 2005, 2006, 2007, 2006 was still a difficult time, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, it started where I felt, okay, now most of the strong patterns, they are gone, and my life and my mind really became easier and joyful. And but up to there, 10, 15 years, it was really, it's a struggle. It was quite a struggle.
Speaking of the struggle, I'm a meditator myself, and I always wonder, is there going to be an end to all the fears and the agitation of the mind and emotions? Did you reach a point where you eradicated most of the agitation of your mind and the monkey mind and most of your low frequencies, emotions, as I call it, so fear, anxiety? Did you get to that point where you felt free, or there was still something there, or is there still something there that you need to eradicate?
On a rough level, I feel quite free from it. I can still think back when those experiences first started, and that was 2001, 2002, where the first experiences started, where your mind is just, it's without thought. You just sit there, you look. It's just clear. And from that time on, it evolved more and more. So nowadays, I don't have many thoughts. I use my brain when I want to think about something. But otherwise, it's just white, clear, open, joyful. And if you don't have many thoughts, you also don't have many emotions, because the emotions, they come from the thoughts. So the more you get into that wide, clear space of mind, and the more you are inside there, fears, emotions, everything just naturally starts to decrease. And in the opposite, compassion naturally starts to well up. That compassion that feels and still sees the suffering of the others and just wishes nothing more than, if I could just give my mind to everyone, and everyone could just be in that state. Yeah, but we can't. So.
Thank you.
So yeah, go on. There is a point.
Hey.
Hi.
I was just wondering what could the average person, like most of us here, what could we do to make our lives better? If we've got families and friends and commitments and responsibilities, what can we do to help alleviate some suffering from ourselves and maybe even help other people?
Starting to create, to learn, to develop mindfulness. Which means, like I said before, mostly we live our life in just habitual patterns. We function. We are not mindful about what we do, what we say, what we think. Mostly we don't even know what we think, and many times we don't know what we say. We say things, and then we say, no, I never said that. But yes, we did. We did say it. And that happens a lot, and that's because we are not mindful. So something that is really most important, and that's what the whole path is about, if we want to get to a point of peace and happiness and joy and compassion and kindness, to develop mindfulness. And this we can do in every situation of our life. It just means always trying to recollect, to reflect, okay, what's going on right now? We are walking on the street. How am I walking? Recently, a friend in Austria, a young boy, he's like lots of energy, and he's like walking like that. And I say to him, are you aware of how you're walking? And he looks at me and he says, no, why? I say, you're walking like that. And he says, okay. So, yeah, we are not even aware of that. So start building up awareness, like mindfulness. Whenever we have to try to remind ourselves again and again and again, for a moment, whatever we are doing, maybe just for a moment, okay, look inside for a moment. What I'm just talking now, how I'm just moving now, what's happening in my mind, what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling. And if we train in that, of course, it's very difficult in the beginning, and we maybe we'll always forget it. So we are in the age of technology, so we can use the technology in our help and maybe put an alarm every hour or something that kind of reminds us, reflect back for a moment. And to enhance it, or to a little bit make it easier, it's probably, if we can and if we like to, it's definitely beneficial if we can in the morning when we get up, sit for a few minutes, and try to focus our mind to the inside, and also try to focus on our mind maybe on a certain motivation, like, what do I want to accomplish today? How do I want to be? And the same in the evening, before we go to sleep, sit down for a few minutes, reflect what had happened. How did you react on certain things? And start trying to see how we act, and then we can also reflect and say, okay, that's not so good, I should try to be more mindful on that and try to change it. That's the most beneficial and very important practice. And then, of course, like we say, practice certain points like patience, which all the other practices, it needs mindfulness, because, of course, in that moment you have to be mindful if somebody makes you angry, you have to be mindful to even be able to be patient, because otherwise we just react out of the pattern. Like, be patient, try to be generous, try to be kind, and we try to be moral, be disciplined, like don't live a too crazy wild life, especially which harms other people, like we try not to harm other people, be mindful about that we don't hurt and harm other people through what we say and through what we do and think.
just wondering if you had a comment on the current on science, quantum science, now beginning to prove essentially what the yogis and the tantrics have been talking about for thousands of years, and the notion that some awakened beings and gurus are talking about, that this notion of more of a sort of acceleration of awakening and sort of a mass awakening.
I don't know too much about that, but my younger brother, he always shows me some movies and documentaries and talks with me about those things. So it seems like what I understood from what my brother tells me, that through the science and the quantum physics, as you say, or something, they're getting to the point now to kind of understand what we call emptiness of objects, that there is actually no real material matter, yeah, that it's all energy that manifests. So, which is the basic view in Buddhism, yeah. So, at first when I heard that, I was a little bit excited about it. I thought, wow, that's great. Now the scientists, they're starting to prove what Buddha in his wisdom understood, and what every one of us can understand through meditation. I mean, that's what we experience through going deep into the mind. So, but now it's getting proven by the science. So first I thought, it's great. But then I thought, there might also be a danger about it. Because on the path, if we, like I said, through the meditation, through the purifying of our negative habits, and through creating and strengthening the positive thoughts and the positive things, and through slowly going on the path, through our meditation, where we get deeper and deeper into the mind, and we get deeper and deeper into that understanding and into that insight, simultaneously, compassion grows. Seeing that, because you really, it's not something you study, because there's a big difference about understanding something or really, how to say, experiencing it. So we can understand emptiness by reading about it, by reading about the philosophy, studying the philosophy. But if we are not practicing, it always says, emptiness, like the actual nature of all the phenomena, cannot be understood by the mind. It can only be experienced. So whatever we talk about, it's like just using examples. Like our deep nature is like the endless white sky. No up and down, no left and right, no center, no outwards. It's just objectless. And we can imagine things and we can think about things and they can make sense for us. But if we don't experience them, then also this other side, which is wisdom and compassion, wisdom is to realize the actual nature of the phenomena and the nature of our mind, which is emptiness, which is illusory, which is dreamlike. And simultaneously, the more we realize that, the more compassion grows for the beings who are not seeing that. And because of not realizing that, because of not experiencing that, beings are bound by thoughts, which come to negative emotions, which make all the suffering, which is actually everything not necessary at all. So, but the science, when the science starts proving that, then the compassion side is missing. So then I don't know what will happen. They will come out and say, okay, everything is just emptiness. Don't bother, you're not really there, and nobody else is really there. So, okay, we can just go and harm, and take whatever we want, and do whatever we want, because we don't feel like they might lose I'm afraid if they might lose morality about it, like not in general the people, but like those, I don't know, those, my brother always tells me about those leading, very greedy kind of people who lead the world, seems like, and try to keep people in the ignorance, like not helping them to really find their path, but rather keep them in the habitual pattern, keep them inside there, like with all the business which is always done, advertisement and all that stuff, keep people going like that. So I don't know. It might become dangerous also, I was thinking.
I was more talking about functional sciences, being able to measure things like resonance, heart resonance.
Like what?
Heart resonance, so measuring energies and using functional MRI, so functional scanning of the brain to look at increased neurological activity in the compassion area in the brain and things like that. And I suppose what I meant was, in that sense, there are a lot of sort of, you know, Yogananda and other sort of gurus that have said, and it's related to someone else's question about living in the West or living wherever, doing your day-to-day thing, but being mindful, being contemplative, and perhaps the necessity to spend years in solitude, which not everyone can do anymore, as being another path to enlightenment too.
I mean, it's not necessary. It's not necessary to spend years in solitude. Last time when I was asked about it, I kind of said, I think it's about the hurry we have, like the hurry we have to understand, to attain insight. So as I was in big hurry, I went into that solitary. But if you're not in very much hurry, like if you say, okay, I'm okay, I know now what I have to be careful about and what I want to slowly develop, then we can just do it in daily life. But for me, it's just with the science and all that, it's the point where I said before, it's like all in the outside. It's like all in the outside. Of course, it's of benefit. It's being used of benefit, but it's also many times it's also used of not benefit, like of the opposite. And therefore, whatever science develops, I feel the most important that people develop awareness and mindfulness, how to go about it. Like all this technology we have now here, easily is misused if people don't have mindfulness about using it. And maybe I don't really answer your question, but it's also a little bit too difficult English for me.
Tara, I'm going to be... Can you hear me? I'm going to be selfish and jump in here. In response to what you said about compassion, I was struck by how you're talking about it. You're not saying my compassion grows or, you know, I feel more compassion. You're saying compassion grows. And I'm interested in where this compassion comes from and how when it arises in you, what that feels like and what its sort of origin is, if that's an answerable question.
Well, its origin, I guess, would be in the oneness we have. Like it's not like we seemingly we are like individuals, but when we talk about the nature of mind, and in Buddhism we talk about the Buddha nature, which every single being has the Buddha nature, which in Christianity maybe we would say God's nature, or yeah, the godly nature in everything, like everything is God, everything is the last, the final, this pure, all-pervading, what we also call emptiness, like the base on which appearances grow, but the nature of it, the base, where the with the quantum physics also come to this point, what they also call kind of emptiness, where it's only energy, like this base which is within everything, within everyone and everything. And this base in its nature is compassion. Because it's only our individuality we are sticking to that makes us, my happiness versus your happiness. Because if you're eating that bread, I can't have it. So it's only on that outer level of individuality. But the actual nature of being, there's that oneness that pervades everywhere. And that oneness, when you start going into that more and more, then that's the compassion. That's the compassion that arises, that feels what I said before, that just wants everyone to experience that state and to be in that state.
Thank you. That's a very profound thing to hear.
Tara, thanks for your talk. It was very inspiring. I wanted to ask a bit about you've done practice in places that are not only solitary retreats, but perhaps places where other people have done retreat over many, many years. And so I wanted to ask about the significance or importance of doing retreat in particular places. So not only that it's quiet, but that there's a tradition of practice in a particular place. And you mentioned Milarepa and Lapchi being an important place that Milarepa travelled to. So I guess I just wanted to ask about that aspect of your retreat.
It makes a difference what place we are in. For up to a certain stage, it makes a difference. At some point, of course, it doesn't make a difference anymore. But as I just said, also kind of like the basic of everything is on an energy level. So same it's with the places where we are. If in places where great masters who had a great wisdom and compassion level, who do many prayers for the benefit of all beings and who really are there with their insight and with their compassion, that lives, that gives that place a certain energy. And it gives we call it a blessing, it's blessed places. So to be in those places, not only does it make our mind kind of naturally already more peaceful, there's also a saying from Buddha, prophecies, it says that if you're in holy places where great masters and what we call bodhisattvas, and also like Jesus, we call him a bodhisattva, means someone who cares whose main aim is for the benefit of the beings. So if we practice in those places, also our practice will be enhanced much quicker. As Buddhist philosophy is almost like scientific, they have all these exact terms and exact sayings. So they also say, like, if you're in a place like that, 1 year is like 7 years practice in another place from the power of, from the power of the merit and the insight you get. So it makes a difference, yeah. If we have the possibility to choose.
Hi, I kind of have two questions, but I'll try and just ask one. I wondered if you could speak to anger, and there's a lot of stuff going on in the world at the moment that I think we're quite far removed from, especially political climates in America, England, even here in Australia. So how do you remain compassionate when you're dealing with a lot of negative, form of a better phrase, emotions coming up? Obviously they're going to move through you, but how do you feel that practicing is actually instigating change or contributing towards a solution rather than just being passive or quiet?
I'm not sure if I understood everything, but yeah, how you react on the negativity that's happening around, kind of. In general, like, negativity which is directed towards myself personally, it doesn't hurt me. It just, in that moment, it just creates, again, the thought of compassion. Because I understand in that moment what's happening with that person, how much suffering he must have inside, how much confusion, how much difficulties in his life, how little mindfulness, that he can just, sometimes for no reason, you meet people and they're just aggressive. So I immediately feel kind of sad, compassionate for that person. And how it would help in the world, how was it like, how it would help if we practice?
More just so how you feel that your own kind of meditation or compassion or sitting can contribute to feeling like you're creating active change, I suppose, or participating.
Okay. Well, at that moment also, if you meet, you go in a shop or you go somewhere, you meet aggressive people or sad people or something, if you're not drawn into that, like, mostly it's people aggressive to you, then sometimes, like, just in reaction, we are aggressive back. So if instead you're compassionate back, and you're kind back, and you're just nice, the people quite quickly mostly come out of their negativity and of their frustration, and at least for a moment, it seems like they're out of it, and suddenly they're, like, really nice and friendly, and they're laughing. So that already in our immediate, what we meet with people, it makes a total difference how you react on someone. And same on the bigger level. I mean, I cannot, I cannot change any suffering in that way. But if we can change for individuals, then maybe that person again goes with a little bit happier feeling that evening, goes at home, it goes on to their people. And as I said before, if everyone just individually would more consider that and go more into mindfulness and spreads less negativity, then it benefits, it goes to the whole society.
I just wanted to ask you a question about whether, when you were at the retreat, did you ever get sick? And my question is just trying to understand, was there a correlation between the calmness of your mind with the health of your body?
I never got seriously sick. Like, just in my very beginning when I came to India, the typical everyone has diarrhea and whatever goes on. But, I had later on in my retreats also, before I was up in the solitude, during the time when I was in the retreat center in the mountains, I had for 1 year, I had a parasite. And I tried chemical medicine, I tried traditional Ayurveda, Indian medicine, I tried traditional Tibetan medicine, and nothing would just help. So that was for 1 year quite a problem, and my Lama actually was almost at the point where he said, maybe I should return to my country. But then my other Lama, whom I get the connection to later, he said, don't go. He made what we say a kind of a prediction or so, and he said, don't go, just go back to your retreat, just practice, stop running to all the doctors, stop taking all this medicine. He gave me some visualization and some prayers, and he said, just focus back on your practice. And it went. So I don't know how, but yeah. But besides that, and then later, after all these years sitting in the cold and in the mountains, because of my accident I had before, and because not taking really care of my body for like 20 years, not doing much exercise or doing anything, so yeah, then I had problems. Also now again, since a few days. But yeah, it doesn't really matter. And until some years ago, I actually thought when I'm 50, I will sit in a wheelchair, but I didn't care about it because I really thought, and I really had this total assurance that if you are intact with your mind, if the mind really is stable and clear and joyful, then the outer suffering, it's just on an outer level. We don't perceive it as a suffering, because that's the other thing. I mean, the actual suffering happens in our mind. The actual suffering happens in the mind that doesn't want it and that doesn't accept it and which always looks for outer happiness. So once you go a little bit beyond that outer level of happiness and suffering, like just seeing it kind of illusory, then okay, I sit in the wheelchair, so what? I don't care. But it seems not to happen now. So, yeah. But I was never otherwise than that. I was never seriously sick. Even though in the high mountains with the snow and in the cold, never, nothing.
Thank you.
Can you maybe talk to us about some of the biggest struggles that you had on your path, internal struggles? So was doubt ever an issue, or were there particular thought patterns that were more ingrained and more difficult to eradicate?
Well, one, like I said before, one main thing is the patterns, our habitual patterns. That's the main struggle, the main, because that's what the whole path is about, to get rid of these patterns, and they are so strong. That was the main difficulty, and then doubts, of course they come sometimes, especially when we go through difficulties. That's always then when this other side of us says, what are you doing? Just doesn't make sense. Just, you sure? Maybe you better stop it. So that kind of doubt, of course, came quite many times when I was in real difficult situations, but I always knew it's just that tricky, I don't know, that it's again from the habitual pattern that just kind of tries to trick you back into its old life. So, because my Lama also always told me that be careful on all that habitual patterns. Don't take them serious. Don't let them, like, take win over you, like, yeah. So that, yeah, those were the main struggles. I had three times, like one time I don't know, I couldn't handle something obviously, and I almost got crazy. I had like a few days where I quite was out of my mind, like just crying whole time and not knowing what's happening, and but I always, and similar like that, I had for three times over all these years, I had something also like a darkness I was falling in for a few days. And but I never lost my faith to this symbol of Buddha, to the blessing of Buddha and to my teacher. So I always, even though I didn't see a path anymore, I didn't see light anymore, I didn't see the meaning, I didn't know anymore what I was doing there. And I must honestly say, I actually, in the very first time when I had that kind of happening, I was even thinking about, like, being in that emotional, in that state where you actually want to die, like thinking you want to kill yourself. But then I thought, okay, it doesn't help. If I kill myself, next life comes. It's just going on. So I knew already it's not a solution. So it even was like a little bit even worse, because not even that I could do, because knowing it's not a solution, but because knowing you just have to go through, there is nothing else, you have to go through. And also these struggles, everything is impermanent. That was also always nice to remember. Also the suffering and the struggle is impermanent. Also that goes by. Even if you're maybe not able to really solve it or to really go beyond in your practice, but still, it's impermanent, it will go by. So I knew even if I can handle it or not, it will go by. So, and that's what it always did. And because I never lost my faith also, so I could always really pray and keep the faith and just kind of wait and, yeah, just sit it through. Just sit it through.
Perhaps this needs to be the last question for tonight.
Hi, Tara. Thank you for the talk today. It's been illuminating for those that haven't had the time to have a meditative, contemplative time. In relation to the Buddha nature and even the aspect of, I suppose, having God within your life, do you think that that's something that you see in around you in Western life, that perhaps the sense of self, we see it, we're separate from, I suppose, the interdependence of nature or God or the Buddha self, in the sense that perhaps we see ourselves as being separate from the world around us rather than actually being a part of the world around us, whether that be in relation to consciousness or even, you know, the clothes that we wear, you know, which represent, you know, sort of plants and so forth, that they're basically nature is a part of us. Do you think that in the Western life that we are so strongly hold to our identity that we think we're separate from, I suppose, the other sort of parts of life?
I mean, yeah, that's basically what separates us. Our identifying as I. So we identify me, I. We identify with what we like, what we don't like, what we want to, what we wear, what we eat, who is my friend, who is my enemy, and because of not being in touch with that basic Buddha nature or godly nature, which again puts us into that oneness with everyone, and which also makes us see that what we think of an I and me, it's basically not more than habitual patterns and thoughts that create how we want to be or how we think we are and how we identify ourselves with that. And the more we get in touch with that pure nature within us, with that white, nature that is free of judging and free of characteristics, how it is. It's just that it's just this all-pervading godly light, nature, Buddha nature, wisdom. The more we get in touch with that, the more we also understand that what we think that is I, is me, is actually just a creation of our not understanding, not seeing the things right. And because of identifying with that, we're making these borders, and we do what is important for us, but maybe not so much look for what is important for the others. And yeah, definitely that creates the space between us and the others. Therefore, we say also in Buddhism philosophy, it says, they talk about the negative emotions of the mind, like hatred and desire and pride and jealousy. And from all of that, the root is ignorance. And that means that ignorance means that ignorance doesn't mean we are stupid. I would call anyone stupid. That ignorance means that we are not seeing that God nature, not this pure nature, that we are not in contact with that. And because we are not in contact with that, our morning to evening, everyday life is about what we want and what we not want. It's always about that. Whole life is about that. And that creates friends and it creates enemies. So, yeah, it's all in creation of not being in touch with that nature.
Thank you. Is there any way you would like to finish off this evening? We discussed potentially having a few moments to reflect. Are you up for that?
We just sit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you like to guide us through what we should do? I think the idea is we'll have just a few minutes of silence, is that right?
Yeah, maybe just sit silently and try to be in instead of out.
You tell us
and
when to stop.
And maybe try to connect with a feeling of that oneness.
Okay, well I'll leave it to you to lead this. Thank you.
And you have to stop it because, I don't know, otherwise it might go on for too long.
Okay. Well, let's just do this for a few moments if you're comfortable with that. Otherwise you can just sit, which is what we'll all be doing anyway. So.
And you just do as you're comfortable. You open your eyes or you keep them closed as you feel comfortable.
Okay. Tara, thank you on behalf of all of us. Thank you so much for this evening. For me personally, it's been a very, very inspiring and very grounding experience to share, to share in your presence. I'm very grateful, and I think everyone else has been very touched as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. And yes, just a little reminder, if you have a couple of dollars to spare, there's a donation box at the back. Will help cover Tara's accommodation and transport for us. But thank you for coming this evening. I hope you found it beneficial. I found it amazing and inspiring. Thank you. A small gift for you as a token of our appreciation. Tom, if you'd like to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.